continues and that we can continue to be a instrument in which you can not only receive information, but to share accurate information. And thank you all for so much for being a part of this community, for being a part of this community radio station. I want to thank my engineer, Ray. I want to thank all you listeners and for all you who are people who continue to live a life of honor, of respect, of love. Thank you so much. I'm Cecil, and I will speak to you next time.
Hey, what's up, everyone? It's Greg McVicar, creator of Undercurrents, and this is KBOO 90.7 Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bureau of Labor and Industries Child Care for Construction, a program dedicated to helping working families in the trades in partnership with Business Oregon. More info is available at oregon.gov/BOLI/apprenticeship under the link Financial Assistance for Registered Apprentices.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, non-commercial, listener-sponsored, full-strength community radio for Portland, Oregon, the Pacific Northwest, and beyond. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle. We are living in wild times. Today's show looks at some of the history that the current federal administration wants to erase, histories to learn from and histories to build on. Histories of colonialism and environmental damage, and of resistance, collaboration, and beauty. On today's Old Mole, we'll hear about renewed pretensions that nuclear power is necessary, never mind the toxic radioactivity, and we'll hear about the radical life and poetry of KBOO's own Judith Arcana, who passed at the end of last year. KBOO is part of the ongoing history of resistance. We've been on the air since 1968, and we're going to keep sharing our locally rooted and diverse information and culture. And you can join us and help us continue by becoming a member or increasing your donation and participation. You can go online at kboo.fm/give or click on the red donate box in the mobile app or text KBOO to 44321. Or mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. In our first segment today, Jan Hocken talks with Catherine Chetty about the Biden and Trump differing visions of a nuclear renaissance and how the rapid expansion of AI data centers with a promise of nuclear reactors to generate their massive electricity demands has mobilized resistance across the country. While the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act of 2022 provided increased federal funding for next-generation nuclear reactors, the Trump regime has aggressively expanded federal funding for nuclear energy under the guise of national security. Jan and Catherine also discuss changes in the nature of seductions used to bamboozle the public and the increasing visibility of the damaging alliances among energy, finance, and government powers. They note attempts to erase histories that we need to learn from, as well as impending attempts in Oregon and Washington state legislatures to reverse Pacific Northwest citizen opposition to nuclear dangers. Catherine Chetty is a member of the Oregon Conservancy Foundation's Board of Directors, co-chair of Sierra Club's Nuclear Free Team, and an associate producer of the film Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, which was directed by Jan and is now available for free on YouTube. The left community lost one of its stalwarts on winter solstice of 2025. Judith Arcana was a writer, poet, teacher, and feminist activist. She's most well known for being one of the Janes, a pre-Roe underground collective in Chicago that provided 11,000 illegal but safe abortions to desperate women. Judith was also a beloved figure around the KBOO studios, where she hosted a monthly poetry show from 2016 to 2020 called Poetry and Everything. Today, Patricia Kullberg charts her life and activities, including readings of poetry and prose in her own voice. You can find more of Judith Arcana's work and work about her linked on the KBOO page for this segment, and you can share your own tribute to her with the KBOO community by leaving a voicemail at 971-801-1396. That's 971-801-1396. Later this week, you can find out why, since the 1970s, the U.S. has given more aid to Israel than to any other country. This Thursday, January 15th, at 7 p.m., there will be a panel discussion on the strategic, economic, political, and cultural dimensions of America's support for Israel. Joel Bainan, Wael Elassadi, and Mazen Malik will be speaking at the Fremont Methodist Church, 2620 Northeast Fremont Street. For more information, you can call 503-477-7409. You can also find more information about that event and about all our segments by visiting our website at kboo.fm/oldmolevarietyhour, where you can also find links to subscribe to the show and to support KBOO by clicking on the red donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage. Thanks so much to all of KBOO's members and listeners. And even if you can't make a donation or increase your membership, you can still help us out by sharing links and spreading the word. Okay, here's Jan Hocken and Catherine Chetty.
Welcome to KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour, Catherine Chetty.
Hi, Jan. It's good to be here.
Well, nuclear promoters have for decades proclaimed that the world is entering an exciting new age that they describe as a, quote, nuclear renaissance. Trump's Department of Energy websites December 2025 message proclaims, quote, the American nuclear renaissance is key to President Trump's agenda to unleash American energy, reopening critical nuclear infrastructure and rebuilding a strong nuclear industrial base will help create a record energy production and lower electricity costs, unquote. Well, Catherine, you and I worked on a documentary film, Atomic Bamboozle, that looks at the history of propaganda behind the decades-long promise of a nuclear renaissance. So let's start with what is new with nuclear under the Trump regime and their corporate supporters beyond their bombastic claims.
Well, what's new, at least at this time, is the massive amount of federal dollars that it's like it's on steroids. And it, even though prior to this current year, there was money coming in for all forms of energy to address the climate crisis that we're in, primarily in the Biden administration, the Infrastructure Act that committed a tremendous amount of resources, primarily financial, to building out our energy grid and our energy resources so that we could lower greenhouse gas emissions and address the climate problem. Now, suddenly, we've shifted to an atmosphere of a race to have energy dominance in the world and to use taxpayer dollars to fund primarily oil, gas, and nuclear, as opposed to renewable sources of energy across the country. So that I see that as the biggest shift within the last year or two that we're facing.
Yeah, this energy dominance is notable also in the shift away from the promotion that of models that is still part of the picture of these small modular reactors that we feature in the film Atomic Bamboozle, where they're promoted through more feminine imagery, the cozy little reactor next door versus these big phallic towers. Well, the Trump regime is really into big phallic imagery.
Yes.
Even as hollow as most of that is.
An additional element that we're seeing is the press for the energy demands are now being forecast. Initially, it was because of electrification and transitioning away from oil and gas. But within the last year to year and a half, suddenly we have this explosion of data centers and artificial intelligence, where we are being told that we need to fund and bring online much more energy generation resources to be able to do this supercomputing and to do the large language models that are involved with the artificial intelligence push. And so that is suddenly at the forefront and really kind of outbalancing our need to address the climate issues and also make sure that people have disaster preparation and we can keep the lights on, that kind of thing.
Yeah, this data center boom, as OpenAI, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and other corporations invest hundreds of billions of dollars to build the giant computing sites that are advanced as part of the AI future we're asked to embrace. It involves a lot of overcoming local resistance to them, as well as being fortified on the financial front and political front by the federal government and in many cases through the states. What about this case in Texas? That's something that you've talked about with Rick Perry, who's also featured in Atomic Bamboozle with the claim of we're going to make nuclear power cool again. How is Rick Perry trying to make nuclear cool again through data centers in Texas?
Well, he and a billionaire in Texas have joined together to take 5,800 acres outside of a nuclear weapons plant in Texas. And it's a massive data center project that will be privately owned and giving privately owned nuclear powered energy grid for AI. That's their aim. And they're calling it the Donald J. Trump Advanced Energy and Intelligence Campus.
Oh, of course. Nothing has ever been smarter, bigger, better than this.
Right. And I would say that's another element of the new over the last couple of years, which is suddenly what we have these billionaires that are committing massive amounts of money for energy generation and in the effort to build data centers and come up with this artificial intelligence. And so the nuclear industry has been in decline and languishing pretty much over the last several decades. And the influx of, first of all, federal money, government money, and then now it's being reinforced with private money. And they've essentially created this model that is public-private partnerships. And a lot of that means that these billionaires are attempting to jumpstart the industry and get their energy needs met and their water. They're going to need a lot of water as well. So it's this kind of counterbalance to what do we need for people across the country to have enough water and to have enough electricity. Suddenly we have billionaires contributing tremendous amounts of money. And it's not just industry, it's essentially convincing our politicians on both sides of the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, that we need the artificial intelligence, we need the data centers to run our cell phones and to do all those magical things. And therefore, the billionaires are willing to put their money in, but they're also drawing on governments, both at the state level and the federal level, to contribute and to create policies that give them almost unfettered rights to. They're resisting the guardrails that some legislators think are necessary around data centers and around water use and electricity generation. And so they really have a lot of influence with the people who are decision makers, who are deciding whether or not these data centers are going to have tax breaks, whether or not these nuclear startups are going to have access to kind of a streamlined way that sets aside some of the things that we've come to rely on when we think our energy is safe and it's not going to produce health effects that are going to affect our lives.
Yeah, this seems like a more difficult bamboozle, in the sense of the bamboozle is a form of trickery where you're seduced into endorsing something that defies logic when you begin to look at it more carefully. So it's a seduction kind of form of trickery. And some years back, the bamboozle was, this was a way to deal with our very real fears of climate change and climate catastrophe, that this offered clean energy. And that was the key selling point. And scary images of the climate crisis were routinely set against these kind of contained, clean, futuristic images. Often the models were set against like Swiss Alps scenery and beautiful scenery to emphasize their beauty and harmony with nature. Now, the bamboozle is a much more difficult sell because these data centers are horrifying. AI dominating our future is like a sci-fi disaster film that we're now expected to endorse and inhabit rather than just understand as a cautionary tale. I mean, bamboozle operating in that it's the seductions of it are far less apparent?
Well, I think there's a blend of them, of the seductions. The threat of seduction runs through it. That one of the seductions is this is just around the corner. It's the magical thinking. It's we've got the answer and don't worry about it. We're just going to make these things happen. And the delays and the costs are never fully addressed. There's a lot of transparency issues. What you'll see when these startup companies are attempting to get financing and attempting to get politicians to support them with policy is you see these lovely little renditions, like you're describing, of the finished product, but none of these small modular reactors are actually, they're not through a design certification except for one, and they haven't been able to demonstrate that they can operate safely. So you've got these beautiful pictures. For instance, there's a small modular nuclear reactor proposal at Hanford in the state of Washington, and it's sponsored by, and the initial funding, even though it was initially through the Public Utilities and Energy Northwest, which is the collection of public utilities in the Pacific Northwest and located in Washington that runs the nuclear power plant there. They have this proposal where it's still being called a feasibility study. They want to put four small modular nuclear reactors at the Hanford site, which is essentially a sacrifice zone from the World War II plutonium atomic bomb days. And they want to turn this into, if you look on their website and you look at Amazon's renderings about this, because Amazon is the major funder right now, you see these beautiful buildings, and it's lovely. They're trying to sell it like this is a smaller land footprint. So unlike all those wind turbines and unlike all those solar panels, you can get a small footprint energy generation facility. And so that's part of the seduction, not paying attention to if that there are risks where if you have a nuclear accident, and if those small modular nuclear reactors that haven't even shown they can operate safely, if they go bad, that's going to contaminate whatever area is around that property. So that's part of the seduction, is to stay away from the risks and to paint this picture of these small things that are going to have big outcomes for addressing our climate risk and also keeping our energy going.
Yeah, the Hanford site is an ongoing tragedy, and a tragedy that came out of World War II and the production of plutonium for the nuclear atomic bomb, and also the push for the Atoms for Peace campaign that followed that era through Eisenhower and Washington and Kennedy. And I think it's part of the rewriting of history that we're seeing a lot with the Trump administration too, and the far right, and reimagining a past that is a fantasy that relies heavily on repression of an actual history. You know, the nuclear right. Renaissance is, it's invoked as a kind of perpetual mantra and a form of magical thinking, as you said earlier. The imagined golden era to which we are invited to return is, in fact, the 1950s and 60s. And so in a way, where the Renaissance operates as both a signifier of a past, but also as a repression of the actual past, barring us from actually thinking about what that return would really mean. Can you say anything about that hazy nostalgia without content in the nuclear Renaissance?
Yeah, I think one of the things that comes to mind is that out at Hanford, it's a tragic history. And the people who lived there and worked there have their memory of it in their writing and in their speaking is of a time when they all had jobs and it brought economic viability to the area. And yet it displaced the tribes that were using that land. It was part of their usual and accustomed ways of gathering food and fishing. And those tribes continue to this day to have great concern about adding any more of the nuclear contamination from siting nuclear power plants that produce waste there. And so there's this back and forth between it was an economically vital time, people got jobs.
And you see some of that celebrated in Hanford and museums there and local people you're saying. In a way, there were for many white people.
Right, exactly.
And that kind of emerging middle class of the 1950s, some level of prosperity that has been dismantled in the decade capitalism that followed.
And in order to sell this new proposed advanced, it's called the Cascade Advanced Energy Facility. It doesn't even use the word nuclear. In order to sell that to people, it's being framed as this is not the old contaminated Hanford. The waste that's being generated isn't the plutonium waste, even though the waste that's being generated currently there by the Columbia Generating Station, which is an operating nuclear power plant, and the waste that will be generated by adding 4 to 12 more reactors there will continue to sit at that site. And there's no federal depository that's safe for the waste that's being generated. So people who have concerns about it are asking that we not add any more waste until there's a federal solution for permanently disposing of that waste. There are 94 nuclear power plants across the country that have casks sitting there with nuclear waste that can't go anywhere. As the phrase is, the nuclear garbage man hasn't come to pick that up yet.
Yeah, including here in the Trojan site.
But Columbia Generating Station also. Every nuclear power plant that gets built has to have a way to store that, the spent fuel rods there. So yes, at Trojan, that operated for a certain number of years, there's a pad there with casks holding spent nuclear fuel that has nowhere else to go. And at the Columbia Generating Station as well, at Hanford right now on that reservation. And then if you put 12 more reactors there, they're also going to be generating and storing that spent fuel.
Yeah, part of the dilemma for resisting this industry and its seductions is how effectively the industry has been able to use the categories of clean and dirty.
Yes.
And the boundary between clean and dirty has a long history as a kind of moral boundary between a dominant group under colonialism and now we're seeing it under the white supremacy that dominates the Trump regime, where marginalized people and countries, immigrants are cast as dirty or garbage versus white Christians that are in the fold of the clean. And the industry has long used that distinction in claiming this is clean energy set against the visible dirt of coal and oil. And of course, we don't see radioactive waste, and it is literally hidden underground. So its toxicity is less palpable to people.
So it's at both ends of the fuel cycle. So if we're collecting that waste from the spent fuel, irradiated fuel, there are now 1,000 abandoned uranium mines in this country. We're going to have to go after more uranium if we're going to do these advanced reactors. And so there's...
Because Russia has been the primary source of fuel that
right.
is vital and, to industry.
And Canada also, but Russia primarily. But these sites have not been adequately cleaned up. What we're looking at is an administration that's willing to pour money into making more of it, but is clawing back or avoiding cleaning up those mines, including at Hanford. They've had their workforce cut. They've had their funds cut. Our representatives in Washington are fighting that. To get the cleanup is supposed to last the rest of this century at that site, and it needs to be adequately funded. But suddenly, when budgets come up and money gets allocated, the money to clean up Superfund sites and to clean up the uranium mines across the country, that's on the chopping block, while people's lives who live in the areas where uranium is mined, primarily indigenous people, are facing. Now there's talk of reopening these mines and or doing new ones. And in order to satisfy the current administration's emphasis on energy independence, we want to dominate out there in the world, but we don't want to depend on any other country. So let's come back to the United States and figure out all the places that we can go and mine this uranium, which is, again, undercutting that seductive idea that this is a clean way of producing energy. It's diabolical.
I think part of the promise of the revival of the anti-nuclear movement and alliances between anti-nuclear activists and other environmental activists, which has been difficult in recent decades, is the way in which we're seeing alliances among all these corporate interests and the right-wing regime now running this country, that people are seeing more the connections among the interests of these various corporations producing energy, these costly, heavily destructive extractive industries that are so much at the heart of capitalism. And now, of course, the Trump administration kidnapping the president of Venezuela and claiming we're going to run that country and we're going to take the oil from those people. I mean, all of this has more of the sense of a very brute fist without the velvet gloves of how yes. the regime operated in the past and the rationale behind nuclear in the first place around dealing with the energy crisis of the early 70s and all of the kind of happy talk that has been part of this, the kind of cheerful, seductive message. Now, I think the brute force, the brutality and the aggressive destructiveness and alliances of corporate interests around nuclear, oil, and coal, the financial sector, government deregulation around any kind of protective agencies or protective laws. I think that is all more on display now, which I think may give us hope for the movements that are organizing in resistance to all of this.
I think so too. I think one of the problems of the nuclear seduction has been, we saw it in the Bamboozle film where you had Rick Perry standing there with all these young people around him saying, we're going to make nuclear cool again. And those young people are being drawn in, not understanding or knowing about or having awareness of the history. And that's one of the current new things too that's really very troubling, is the way history is being erased. I mean, we're seeing it in the way the January 6th history is being redone. And if you weren't paying attention back in 2021, you would kind of believe that it was a peaceful march to the Capitol and that it's the police who instigated the violence. And so people are suddenly faced with a lot of the history that we have of the harms that have been done in this country are being erased off of websites, erased out of history books. School curriculums are being altered so that people don't learn about the ways that our colonialism has harmed people across our country. So that's a downside too. I think the upside being that those of us who know and remember are connecting with each other and attempting to convey the truth to our young people and to ensure that they somehow someone is capturing that history so that we can preserve it till a time when we can bring it back out in the open.
In closing, I want to let listeners know that Atomic Bamboozle is now available to watch for free on YouTube, and people can also go to the Atomic Bamboozle website for more information. But would you also like to say a bit about what you're doing in closing, either through your work on the Sierra Club Nuclear Free Committee or through your work here with the Oregon
Conservancy Foundation? Sure. Yeah, I'm a board member on the Oregon Conservancy Foundation, which is a longtime nonprofit that has been advocating for keeping fossil fuels in the ground, something that you've been involved with for a long time, Jan, yourself, with the series that you did on fossil fuels and keeping fossil fuels in the ground and advocating renewables, and in particular, fighting these attempts to bring nuclear back into the current picture. I happen to live in both Oregon and Washington. And in Oregon, I was part of the people that passed the moratorium in Oregon. So Oregon is one of a few states that still has a moratorium on siting nuclear power plants. And we're really fighting to keep that moratorium in place. And I also live in Washington, and I'm part of the Washington Sierra Club, and also a small regional group that covers both Oregon and Washington called the Stop Nuclear Work Group. So there are a lot of avenues for people to connect with groups in the area. Columbia River Keeper also, which is kind of straddles, they're located in Portland, but they work on the health and the safety of the Columbia River area. And so we're facing two legislative sessions, short sessions, one in Oregon, one in Washington, that have bills that are trying to overturn the moratorium in Oregon and also trying to advance nuclear in Washington. And so find a way to connect with a group or with people that have information to let your legislator know, whether they're Democrat or Republican. All of them seem to have been vulnerable to the influence of the nuclear lobby, or most of them have. And so we need to let our legislators know that we think that nuclear takes too long, is too costly, and has safety and proliferation and public health risks that we find not acceptable, and that we want them to say no to any more nuclear power, nuclear energy development in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, this is a future we do not want to inhabit, and another world is indeed possible and necessary. Thank you so much.
Well said, Jan. Thank you
for being with us today. And we'll include a few links on the KABU site of where people can continue to tune in to this work. Thanks so much for being with us, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Jan, and thanks for all your efforts on this too.
walk around. I wanna make a joyful sound, 'cause another world is possible.
That was Stephen Smith singing Another World is Possible. And before that, Jan Hocken and Catherine Chetty talking about some of the possible and necessary work to stop the buildup of nuclear power. I'm Fran Michel, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We turn now to Patricia Kullberg with a tribute to the late, great Judith Arcana.
Judith Arcana was a writer and poet, a reproductive rights activist, and lifelong troublemaker. She died this past winter solstice after a debilitating illness at the age of 82. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I was a great admirer of hers and honored to be her friend. Many of our listeners may remember Judith from her three-year stint beginning in 2016 at KBOO, when she produced a monthly poetry show called Poetry and Everything. Her intent was to explore and lift up the voices of other poets. Only in her penultimate show did she showcase some of her own poetry. Here's a clip of Judith reading from January 2020, including perhaps her most well-known poem, What If Your Mother?
Now I'm going to read you a fabulous sentence, which I did not write, written by one of the great ones of our time and this country, Toni Morrison, who said, "It seems to me that the best art is political, and you ought to make it irrevocably political and unquestionably beautiful at the same time." I read that some years back in, I think it was in an interview, collection of interviews with Ms. Morrison, and immediately said, yes, yes, that is so true. And of course, immediately wrote it down everywhere. I think I even have it somewhere on my website. And now I've just read it to you. So here we go with some poems that are decidedly and overtly political. This one's called Sealed Birth Records Challenged in Court. In the old days, everything was secret. You went away to what they called a home, or you stayed inside your own, hiding your belly when you knew you could not keep it. All the signs were danger signs, breasts heavy with yellow cream, darkening nipples, widening hips, desires for food, sex, sleep, all growing with the child, while you stood wide-footed, moving side to side like a broad-bottomed boat, riding the long tide, going out without you. Salty water shifting with a small internal moon until eclipse, when they took the child away and you'd never see it, never know its name, never know if the eyes darkened, mind sharpened, curious about you, if they talked about you, if they said you were first, said you held the baby first. These next two actually are from a collection of mine called What If Your Mother, which is a book that includes poems and monologues about what I like to call motherhood concerns, and not the kind you usually find, let's say, in Hallmark cards. That one, for instance, the adoption poem, and now these next two. This one's called You Don't Know. You think I didn't care about that baby. Didn't wonder if we'd like each other when she turned 14. Didn't think he'd follow anywhere his older brother went. You think we take them out like gangsters, disappear them like generals. You don't know how it works then, do you? You don't know what sits on both sides of the scale, what it means to decide what I got and what I gave that baby I didn't have, baby who couldn't make me laugh, applesauce upside down on her head, couldn't make me cry, taking his first step right off the porch. You don't even know that this is not about regret. You don't know one blessed, I say blessed, thing about it. And another one, actually the title poem from the collection I just alluded to. What If Your Mother? Sometimes when you talk to them in argument, they say, what if your mother had an abortion? And then I say, she did, because it's true. Only that one wasn't me. It was somebody else. Nobody but my mother ever knew that baby. But they mean me. The people who say it mean, what if she aborted me? Like that's hard to answer. They're so stupid. Because what if she miscarried or gave me away? What if I drowned at the beach when I was 3? What if she loved someone else, not my dad? Then I wouldn't be here either. What if? What if? What's the point of asking this phony question? All you could ever answer is, then everything would be different, wouldn't it? One thing's sure, I wouldn't be standing here talking to some jerk who asked me that dumb question. I wouldn't be mad at my mother for doing it, would I? I think you just have to tell these people, get real. That's not what it's all about.
That was Judith reading a couple of her own poems on poetry and everything. When Judith was arrested by Chicago police in 1972 on charges of felony homicide and conspiracy to commit abortion, it was not her first brush with the authorities. 2 years earlier, as a highly respected and well-liked high school teacher outside of Chicago, Judith was fired by the school board in a secret meeting. Among the stated reasons for her dismissal was the charge that she was, quote-unquote, not keeping attendance properly. Judith always laughed when she told this story. Everyone knew, she said, that the students were getting the wrong ideas, that is, radical ideas, and they must have been getting those ideas from Judith and the 2 other teachers who were fired along with her. Where else would wrong ideas come from? If she hadn't been fired, Judith would muse, maybe she wouldn't have gone on to earn an M.A. in women's studies and a Ph.D. in literature. But before she did all that, she did the thing she is maybe most famous for. She joined the underground collective in Chicago called the Janes. From 1969 to 1972, when they were busted, the Janes provided more than 11,000 abortions. They started as a sort of referral service to doctors willing to help out, but they wound up learning and performing the procedure themselves. While there were occasional complications, not one patient died while in their care. Already remarkable during an era when hundreds of women died each year nationwide from botched abortions. The documentary, Our Bodies, Our Doctors, directed by Jan Hocken, explored abortion services in the lead-up to the 2022 Supreme Court decision to allow states to recriminalize abortion. Here's Judith speaking in the documentary about the Janes.
This photograph is actually my mugshot, taken by the Chicago police on, as you see, May 4th, 1972. The bust was actually on May 3rd. 7 Janes were taken. And abortion, when it is illegal, is felony homicide. Those were the charges. We, the women who worked in it, called it the service. In my own case, I actually discovered the service in the summer of 1970 through asking a medical student who was a pal of mine, I may need, do you know? And he said, everybody here, meaning the University of Illinois Medical School at Chicago, everybody here says, call this number and ask for Jane. That was pretty striking to me. I thought, oh, really? The women who worked in it used that as sort of a code name. Call this number and ask for Jane. That was the line. In the main, the medical industry was not the least bit interested in assisting women in those ways. And of course, as we know, the medical industry was not particularly interested in assisting women in many ways. And it was in those years that we saw the rise of the book Our Bodies, Ourselves, which began as a newsprint pamphlet of, I don't know, maybe a dozen pages. It was like contraband. Everybody, we thought, oh my God, look at this. Look what they're doing. And that came out of those years
because the medical industry was not serving the needs of women.
That was Judith in her own words about the Janes, the underground abortion service in Chicago. Back in 1972, the Janes each faced up to 110 years in prison. But when they went to trial, none of the women they had helped out would testify against them. Months later, the Supreme Court issued their ruling on Roe v. Wade, and the charges against the Janes were dropped. No fewer than four films have been made about the Janes. If you're wondering which one to watch, I recommend The Janes, released in 2022, directed by Emma Pildes and Tia Lesson, and co-produced by Judith's own son, Daniel Arcana. None of the other films quite capture the political context of the times like this most recent film. Another documentary about the women's movement of the 60s and 70s that features Judith is called She's Beautiful When She's Angry, released in 2014. It's also worth a watch.
If you only knew how scared I was to tell you, built it up so much in my head that I let you down. If you only knew the pain I put my heart through. Living a life for a life can be tiring, so I choose the truth. But you would say, keep it on the low. Nobody needs to know, they might not see you the same. But I'm too far gone. Now I'm free. Now I'm free. There's no way you can tell me who I'm supposed to be. See, now I'm free. Now I'm free.
That was Kat Burns with her song Free, part of the soundtrack to She's Beautiful When She's Angry. After her stint with the Janes, Judith went on to get her degrees and to teach. She taught in schools, in universities, in prisons, and in people's homes. She taught writing and literature and women's studies. And she wrote. Her first book, Our Mother's Daughters, was about how a sexist society shapes the mother-daughter relationship, and not always in good ways. She followed up with Every Mother's Son, a book about how to raise a boy to be a feminist. My favorite of her books, however, is called Grace Paley's Stories, a literary biography of the writer and activist Grace Paley. The book interweaves biography, social history, and literary criticism to create an astute and endearing portrait of a woman who lived large in both literature and political activism, not unlike Judith herself. Later on, Judith turned to poetry, publishing several collections of verse, including What If Your Mother? Her last book, Hello, This Is Jane, inspired by the growing threat to legal abortion, is a collection of stories about the Janes. Judith insisted on the organically political nature of art and literature. Everything she wrote issued from her activism and was deployed as part of her activism. In conversation with local poet Judith Barrington, Judith had this to say. I could argue that all poetry is political. Indeed, I could argue that damn near everything in human comprehension is by definition political, because we filter everything through our necessarily political location and consciousness. But I know that's not what all the shouting's about in PoBiz. What everybody gets all worked up about in the USA, and pretty much nowhere else, is whether poets ought to engage overtly any political themes or issues, whether by doing so they render their work not poetry. because class and race and unemployment and farm labor are not lyrical, or something like that. That quote is from a conversation between Judith Arcana and Judith Barrington, published online in 2009 in Eclectica magazine. Judith moved from the Midwest to Portland a couple of decades ago, lucky for us. Here's more of her reading on KABU from her book called Fourth Period English.
I've written a lot about abortion in both prose and poetry. And I took a fly at, a shot, a jump at writing about immigration a while back, and then most recently brought a collection back into print called, it's a chapbook from Eberhard Press here in Portland. It's called Fourth Period English, and it was sparked actually by the young people who have now, for the last decade or so in the United States, been called the Dreamers. I was lucky enough to spend time with these kids, and I mean kids, I'm talking 13, 14, 15 years old, plus a few older folks, and then people my age, even older yet, sitting around a dining room table, putting out a mailing, listening to them talk about their lives, how their parents brought them here. And to my astonishment, really, this does happen, people. Some of you know this, some of you don't. You can trust me. I'm telling you the truth. Sometimes this happens. To my complete astonishment, these kids sort of made other kids, fiction kids, kids I made up, come into my brain and talk and talk and talk and talk. So this chapbook has 25 spoken poems, each one spoken by a character or a group of characters. One, for instance, is by the boys' soccer team. One is by two girlfriends together. But what they're all about is that their teacher, Ms. Solomon, has given them the assignment in fourth period English, hence the title, to discuss immigration in literature and life. And naturally, they argue, not to say fight, and have some disagreements. I'm going to read two of those. This one, many of the people in the book speak with a little Spanish in their poetry, and others do not. They come from other places and so on. This one is called Becky Talking. You speak the language pretty good, except you have that accent. You don't sound right when you're talking English. You say it like different from how it really is. My family came here 100 years ago. My grandma says they had to leave home. She tells me stories. She has the hat her own grandma wore on the boat coming here. She worked in a factory making shirts instead of high school. She couldn't read in English. So that's why I'm asking, why did you come? Did you have to leave home? And this one, Aurelia Talking. She's much later in the book after hearing many other people speak. You think we all come from Mexico, and up here, maybe that's the most, but also Guatemala. Do you know where that is? And even Colombia, far away as that is from this huerta, far from these apples and pears. I wonder if you even know these other countries are in the world with you. Like, you call your country America, but it isn't. This place is only Los Estados Unidos, the United States of America, a chunk of a chunk, a piece of a piece, del norte. ¿Comprendes? Do you know Canada has more land up there on top of you? Do you know Brazil is almost as big and it's only one part of America del Sur, the whole south? You think you know where you are, where everybody is and should be, but do you? My girl Aurelia.
That was more of Judith reading her own poetry on her show Poetry and Everything. Judith was funny, smart, compassionate, energetic, and uncompromising. She was a vibrant part of our literary and activist scene in Portland. She will be missed. I want to give the last words today to Judith herself. This is the advice she offered back in 1995, especially to women. But the words hold true today. Here's Judith in an audio clip from the movie Jane, an abortion service.
Assume that you must educate yourself and that you must find people who seek to be conscious and seek to do good and right in the world and be with those people. Seek women and girls who want to have integrity, who want to own their personal power and use it to make their way through life in this world, and hang around with those girls and women. Don't stay where people tell you you're crazy, you're stupid, you're weak. Don't spend time with people who tell you, oh, it's pointless, it's useless, or oh, they tried that, or it's passé, or this is post-feminism. Just say, okay, that's who they are. We're done with that. Now we'll move on to the next. It can be lonely, it can be scary. It will be lonely, it will be scary, but it will not be impossible.
Those are words from Judith Arcana, reminding us that a better world is not impossible. This is Patricia Kullberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour, speaking about my friend and comrade Judith Arcana, who died last month. The song you are listening to is called Don't You Hear Me Calling by Ike and Tina Turner, from the soundtrack to The Janes.
That was Patricia Kullberg remembering the writer, poet, teacher, feminist activist, and KABU host, Judith Arcana. I'm Fran Michelle, and I've been your host for this episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Thank you to all of today's contributors, Jan Hocken and her guest, Catherine Chuddy, and Patricia Kullberg for editing and for her tribute to Judith Arcana. Thank you to all of the Moles and all of KABU's members, listeners, volunteers, and staff. You can support this independent, non-commercial station by visiting us at kboo.fm/give, or by clicking on the red donate box on the website or on the mobile app, or by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Let me remind you that this Thursday, January 15th, from 7 p.m. to 8:30, there will be a panel discussion on the strategic, economic, political, and cultural dimensions of America's support for Israel, sponsored by the Jewish-Palestinian Alliance of Oregon, American Council for Palestine, Democratic Socialists of America, and Jewish Voice for Peace. It features Joel Bainan, the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History at Stanford University, Wael Elisadi, co-founder of SUPER, Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights at PSU, and Mazen Malik, Palestinian economist. They'll be speaking at the Fremont Methodist Church, 2620 Northeast Fremont Street. For more information, you can call 503-477-7409. That's 503-477-7409. The Old Mole will be back next Monday, which will be both Martin Luther King Jr. Day and a Day Without an Immigrant, organized by PICUN, Piñeros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, the largest farm worker advocacy group in Oregon. The monthly Day Without an Immigrant encourages immigrants across the state to engage in an economic boycott by refraining from attending school, going to work, or shopping. Stay tuned to KABU Now for Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein, featuring a discussion of Portland's economic opportunities analysis, the land use planning review that has tended to happen behind closed doors with giant multinational industrial interests, instead of being a process that engages the true breadth of the community, including social and environmental justice organizations. We'll go out today with John Coltrane playing Alabama from the album Live at Birdland. ¶¶
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue.